This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. European Union's joining France in criticising Australia's new nuclear submarine deal with the US and the UK, with the European Commission President saying the sudden scrapping of the $90 billion contract with France is unacceptable behaviour. And another senior official is warning it'll affect Australia's efforts to secure a free trade deal with the EU because trust has been lost. Europe correspondent Nick Doll reports.
Since last week's announcement, France has had plenty of fighting words, but now the President of the European Commission has gone on CNN to tell the world what her powerful trading bloc thinks of Australia's decision. Ursula von der Leyen is speaking to journalist Christiane Amanpour.
Do you see relations going, you know, in a negative direction in that region with Australia?
Well, there are a lot of open questions that have to be answered. One of our member states has been treated in a way that is not acceptable. So we want to know what happened and why. And therefore, you first of all clarify that before you keep on going with business as usual.
Until last week, Australia had been officially planning to spend $90 billion on French submarines. But secretly, the government was in talks with the US and UK to form a new military alliance and get access to nuclear submarine technology. Australia broke the news to France just before publicly announcing that the deal was off. France said it was a stab in the back. But overnight, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has defended the move.
It's not exclusionary, it's not divisive, and it really doesn't have to be that way. This is just a way of the UK, the US and Australia sharing certain technologies because that is the sensible thing to do in the world in which we find ourselves.
In Parliament, UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace also went into bat for Australia.
There was no sneakiness behind the back. It was fundamentally Australia's right to choose a different capability, and it did.
But those choices will have consequences. Australia is trying to negotiate a free trade deal with the European Union. One of the potential benefits would see Australian farmers getting export access to the enormous European market. Talks were always going to be tough, but they've just got tougher.
The mood of compromise, specifically on the agriculture side, I guess specifically in France, is quite limited.
That's Bernd Langer, the head of the EU's Trade Committee.
At the moment, a lot of trust is gone. I guess a quick conclusion of the agreement is not possible.
Mr. Langer says while France has been the most vocal critic, the submarine project was first and foremost a European one, and many companies and countries stood to benefit, including his own nation, Germany.
It's totally clear that they are totally upset about the situation. Now, everything is gone, and therefore, I guess it will be much more complicated to conclude.
Talks are due to resume next month. The EU's foreign ministers are meeting today to discuss the perceived pros and cons of doing business with Australia. This is Nick Doyle in London reporting for AM.
The Prime Minister is launching into what could be the most important week of diplomacy for Australia in decades. Scott Morrison spending the rest of this week in the US, first trying to explain this country's leap into nuclear-powered submarines to other nations, then teaming up with President Joe Biden and the leaders of Japan and India in yet another powerful statement directed towards Beijing. North America correspondent Greg Jennett is in New York City. Greg, what are the members of the Australia-UK-US Alliance AUKUS saying in order to explain this big strategic shift to wary nations?
They're saying and doing a lot on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly meeting here, or at least the opening days of it, Sabra, because this is a problem, at least a short-term problem, for Joe Biden and Scott Morrison in particular, and one they're both going to have to work separately. So Joe Biden is trying desperately to try to set up a phone conversation with Emmanuel Macron, who is not in New York for the General Assembly this week. week. And Scott Morrison will make it his business throughout much of tomorrow to go about talking to delegations as and when he can. I think there's a particular emphasis on European countries on the 10 and 15 minute fixtures that he's been able to secure. That's separate to his own face-to-face meeting with Joe Biden. But make no mistake, they're putting lots of effort into trying to explain this bold strategic move to countries which either don't get it or somehow feel offended and threatened by it. Certainly that's the case with France.
And once done with those explanations in New York, what actually lies ahead for the Prime Minister?
So it's off to Washington, D.C. after his one-on-one with Joe Biden here in New York. And that's where he'll be going about some business, which is, I suppose, not the main purpose of being here. He's going to attend a COVID pandemic summit that Kamala Harris, the vice president, is convening. But ultimately, the big fixture for him is this Quad meeting on Friday with Joe Biden and with the prime ministers of India and Japan. So if people thought a statement wasn't made loudly enough last week with the strategic nuclear-powered submarines decision and the creation of AUKUS, then you get another one this Friday, particularly if you're sitting in Beijing, you do, because this first face-to-face in-person summit of the Quad leaders is yet another reminder to Beijing that these democracies are uniting and trying to send the loudest possible signal that any coercion will not be tolerated by them.
North America correspondent Greg Jennett there. Construction sites will shut down across metropolitan Melbourne and in some parts of regional Victoria for the next fortnight following violent protests outside union headquarters yesterday. Hundreds of construction workers and anti-vaccination protesters clashed with union officials and police, angry at restrictions being imposed by the government, including mandatory vaccinations. Our reporter Bridget Fitzgerald joins me from Melbourne. Bridget, how significant is this shutdown?
Sabra, the Victorian construction industry has largely been allowed to keep working throughout the pandemic, although at a reduced capacity. There have been brief stoppages, but nothing like this. So this two-week shutdown will apply to all building sites across metropolitan Melbourne, as well as Geelong, the Surf Coast, Ballarat and the Mitchell Shire. A limited exemption will apply for emergency works. What's happened here, Sabra, is that Victorian government has said there's too much transmission on building sites. It recently tightened rules around compliance to make sure that COVID-safe management was being practiced. But it was the mandatory vaccine requirement that's really sparked yesterday's protests and a lot of this anger. The state government engaged in crisis talks last night with the CFMEU, the Construction, Forestry, Maritime, Mining and Energy Union, and made the decision to shut the industry down. In a statement, the state government says the shutdown was needed to reduce movement, minimise transmission and to allow the industry to increase vaccination rates after a concerning spread of cases.
Now, what's the union actually said about yesterday's protests?
Well, much of the anger of these protesters appeared to be aimed at the union itself, as well as at the Andrews government. The Victorian State Secretary of the CFMEU, John Setker, attempted to address the crowd yesterday, but he ended up having to shelter inside the building after having things thrown at him. In a statement, the CFMEU has actually blamed far-right extremists and neo-Nazis for their role in what it's described as an attack on union headquarters. The National Construction Secretary, Dave Noonan, says he knows that there were union members in the crowd, but says the protest was driven by outside forces.
But a small minority, and that's what we had today, a small minority of the membership and the industry being manipulated by zealots, cranks and neo-Nazis is not acceptable, and certainly attacking other construction workers, attacking union officials and vandalising the union office is a complete disgrace.
Bridget, what's been the broader response from the industry to the shutdown?
Sabra, the protests themselves have been largely condemned by unions and industry representatives, but the shutdown itself has also been described as disappointing. The Building Industry Group of Unions also slammed the state government for the vaccine mandate, labelling it unrealistic and heavy-handed. Master Builders Association of Victoria CEO Rebecca Casson says she just hopes that workers can get back to site soon.
the vast majority of our workforce have done the right thing. They have continued to work exceptionally diligently over the last year and a half since the pandemic has started. Our industry has been the engine room of the state's economy, and the people that have rioted are definitely not a representation of our whole industry.
And that's Rebecca Casson, the Chief Executive of the Master Builders Association of Victoria, and before her, our reporter, Bridget Fitzgerald. In the midst of a pandemic, it's not great news when the only doctor's surgery in town closes. That's what will happen in the Tasmanian town of Ouse at the end of next month, because the owners of the Central Highlands General Practice say they can't meet the government mandate for all healthcare workers to be vaccinated. And finding another doctor to fill a gap could be made harder because of border closures. They're slowing down the movement of medical staff around the country, as Alexia Atwood reports.
When you have 9 kids, you really want a doctor nearby. But Darlene Bourne, who lives in the central Tasmanian town of Ouse, may not have that luxury anymore.
It's devastating, to put it mildly. The closest doctors, they have said they're trying to refer people to Bothwell. It's open 2 days a week. They're taking on new clients. Obviously, you know, it's going to be impossible to get into.
The only general practice in Ouse is closing because some staff refuse to be vaccinated, breaching the Tasmanian government's requirement for healthcare workers to have at least one dose by the end of October. Darlene Bourne, who works at the local roadhouse, isn't just concerned about her own family.
The old people I worry about, because they're, you know, so set in their ways and they're really old and they come to the doctors for absolutely everything. Yeah, and they're not just doctors, like they're their best friends.
Tasmanian Health Minister Jeremy Rockliffe says his department is considering how it might support an alternative provider. The Tasmanian chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Tim Jackson, already has an idea.
You know, it's not easy to find locum GPs, but that would be probably what needs to be prioritised.
Even before the pandemic, getting a locum in a regional area was tricky. But the Royal Doctors Association says it's been made harder by border closures, with travelling medical staff not only facing red tape, but 2 weeks quarantine. It's why CEO Peter Rutherford is calling for a national approach to allow healthcare workers to cross state borders if they're needed to provide relief or fill GP vacancies.
We're not asking for this to be just open slather and, you know, let doctors move around here, there and everywhere. But we do see that there is, you know, a role for rapid antigen testing. We think that that's probably been something that's been underutilised in our strategy to date. And certainly only allowing fully vaccinated doctors to be the ones that aren't required to quarantine.
But quarantine-free movement is controversial, especially for a state like Tasmania where there's no community transmission of COVID. Tasmanian GP Tim Jackson isn't so sure it's the answer in this case.
Look, realising it is important to get locums out into where they're needed in the community, I guess it's also important to make sure we're very COVID safe. So, you know, I support the Tasmanian state government's stance on being very strict about who is allowed into the state. Some of those things you suggested, like rapid antigen testing and making sure that locums were fully immunised, that reduces the risk, but not completely. So I guess it's a matter of finding that balance.
Tasmanian GP Tim Jackson, ending Alexia Atwood's report. Now, the question's asked many times when it comes to addressing the issue of men's violence against women and families. Where are the men? What do they make of the campaigns to have them examine attitudes about gender stereotypes and questioning male behaviour? Social affairs correspondent Norman Hamon has been asking men about how they feel on the need for change in the culture of male dominance that can lead to violence.
Talk to 20-year-old university student Joseph Safai about the need for cultural change around gender stereotypes and men's behaviour, and it's not controversial. His generation, he says, is already on board.
Well, it has become a cultural norm that you are respectful towards women, that, you know, you're on equal terms and everyone you interact with is deserving of respect.
26-year-old Akram Kuchakali agrees that for his peer group in the Turkish Muslim community, gender equity is a given. But that's a change from the previous generation, when women stayed home and men were the breadwinners.
The fact that our generation has that education and respects that the female can have education as well, that has, I think, a relatively large impact on the awareness of domestic violence and the reduction of the domestic violence in our households.
But despite this progress, both Akram Kuchikali and Joseph Safai believe when men gather in groups, it's still hard to call out disrespectful and sexist behavior.
Maybe photos that girls might have posted on social media and comments that have kind of come up from that, that you probably hear in the schoolyard, you end up letting slide just because, you know, you're in your group of friends and you don't want to be the one to, you know, stick out from the group.
Jai Tao works for the Men's Project at Jesuit Social Services, helping young men and boys recognize behavior and language that can lead to violence.
They get policed with words like, don't be such a pussy, man up, grow some balls, this kind of thing. If that's the language that you're using to put somebody down, then what are you saying about that demographic of people? A lot of men are not aware of how that plays out. They're not aware of that implication behind that language.
Jai Tao is 46 and spent decades in the world of kickboxing and mixed martial arts. His work with young men has led him to believe the culture that enables violence against women can change, but it has to come from men.
We can change our ideas around the male gender from within, rather than being told from the outside, you need to change your behaviors, you need to change your attitudes, because that's usually just going to be met with defensiveness and resistance. When we talk about gender equality, men often sort of approach that thinking we're talking about something for women. We need to help men understand that gender equality is good for everybody, including them.
Men's Project facilitator Jai Tao ending that report from Norman Hammond. Many in lockdown say they've really missed community sporting events like weekend footy, netball and basketball. Well, it's also affecting the sporting clubs themselves. Many are in financial strife. In some places, memberships have pretty much disappeared and sponsors are running out of cash. David Sparks has more.
A couple of people having a hit in the cricket nets is about as much local sport as you'll see in some parts of the country right now. At the Lakemba Sports Club in southwest Sydney, Ghazi Sangari says the impact of the COVID lockdowns is severe.
It's, I suppose, like every other club, it's catastrophic at the moment. People's mental health, they can't be on the field, they can't be at the park, socialising. We've run a lot of programs for ethnic migrants and refugees. The club helps them integrate into society, understanding way of life in Australia. Unfortunately, that's on hold at the moment.
The club's soccer and cricket teams can't practice or play. And with nothing happening, the money's dried up. But the bills still need to be paid.
Financially, it's been hit hard. A lot of the fees haven't been waived and we've had to pay them throughout the year and some still owing. And we haven't been able to recoup a lot of that money from memberships. A lot of our members pay by installments, where they can. And unfortunately, we can't get that. And the bigger problem now is a lot of struggling families are trying to get refunds where they can to help them get by life at the moment.
In Queensland, the Sunshine Coast Gympie Rugby League was able to play this season after cancelling last year's season. Board member Jody Price says despite getting back on the field, sponsorship dollars are down by about half.
It'll take at least 2 years to catch up again, especially local leagues run on small business sponsors. Committees of all volunteers, no one's paid. So when small businesses are hurting, that actually in turn hurts the sports community as well.
This pressure is reflected in a new survey by the Australian Sports Foundation, which is a non-profit sports fundraising organisation and charity. It found COVID-19 has hit the country's 70,000 community sports clubs in terms of financial security, lower participation rates and the loss of volunteers. 83% of clubs reported a loss of revenue, with the average decline $18,500. Patrick Walker is the Sports Foundation's chief executive.
So whether it was lower memberships, lack of sponsorships, they can't do fundraising because sport has been shut down, they can't do match day events like canteens because sport hasn't taken place. So almost every revenue stream has declined.
Patrick Walker says we should all be worried about the survival of community sport in Australia.
It's about the physical health of physical activity, the improvement to mental health of physical activity and social cohesion, bringing people together with a like-minded interest. Now, all of those factors will be really important in our own recovery as a country from the impact of the pandemic. We're all suffering challenges in our everyday life, and sport plays such a valuable role in getting people together, in getting people fit and active, in forgetting about everyday worries.
Patrick Walker from the Australian Sports Foundation, ending David Sparks' report. That's AM. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
If you're locked down right now, you're probably spending quite a lot of your time imagining how great it'll be when Australia opens up again later this year, at which point life, we hope, will gradually but steadily return to normal. The reality is, though, that next year is far from certain, and things like case numbers, the death rate, and time spent in lockdown really depend on what we do next.
Today on The Signal, we're looking at three different models for how 2022 could look in Australia and what we need to pull off the best case scenario. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.